Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 11-1019, Pulava v. Oahu Construction Co. Arguing for the petitioner, Dan S. Ikahara. Arguing for the respondent, Brian G. S. Choi. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Ikahara, Mr. Choi. You're both ready to proceed? All right. And we have 5 minutes reserved for rebuttal for Mr. Ikahara, so we'll give you a warning with 5 minutes to go, Mr. Choi, a five-minute warning. So if you would, please proceed. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, and may it please the court. Again, Dan Ikahara for Benjamin Pulava. This is a workers' comp case, Your Honor. We need the court's help. Our prayer of relief is that we want the court to approve a medical device called a mnemonics device. And it requires a little bit of treatment, about a six-month follow-up treatment also. And this is for claimant's tinnitus. He suffers from tinnitus. And secondly, we want the court to resume TTD, temporary total disability payments. It was terminated by the DCD as of 12/17/2008, the Labor Appeals Board, LABO Board, affirmed, and the ICA also affirmed.
I didn't hear you.
Yes, yeah. The ICA affirmed. So the denial was upheld all the way through the ICA. So we're asking that.
And you can raise the mic if that'd be more comfortable for you. It does help us to have you speak into the mic so we can hear you. And also we're recording our proceedings. So
thank you very much.
Thanks.
So brief summary of the case. My client, again, this is a workers' comp case. My client was a field supervisor for Oahu Construction Company. And he was working in the Kaka'ako area, the Kaka'ako redevelopment. And the job site was just below McKinley High School, the field, by Kona Street on Kamake'e. And so they were dredging or excavating the road to put utilities in the road. And as a field supervisor, he was on the job site. The excavator scooped up some debris or earth, or coral, I should say, because that area is relatively close to the ocean. And so the excavator was going down about 8 to 10 feet and taking the debris out and piling it on, making a little mound. A loader came by, or the loader comes by and scoops up the debris and puts it in the dump truck to be taken away. The loader, the wheels are made out of rubber, and what happened in this instant was that the loader went over and pinched a chunk of cement that was wet because the debris is like water level, ocean level.
Mr. Ikihara, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just wanted to be clear. There is no dispute in this case about whether this is a work-related injury, correct?
That's correct.
And in fact, in this case, there was a challenge, I guess, by the employer when eventually Mr. Pulava sought a mnemonics device, is that right?
That's correct.
Would you help me with the burden of proof? At that point, when there is a challenge and a decision has to be made by the director, who has the burden in terms of showing whether this mnemonic device is something that is necessary or reasonable?
It would be the claimant's burden of proof. I don't think, if I read the case law correctly, that there is a presumption.
There wouldn't be a presumption.
There wouldn't be a presumption.
Because that would apply just to whether it's work-related.
Correct.
So in this case, you felt it was the claimant's burden. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so when you consider the burden, I'm interested in what the standard would be, because there is some fairly complete discussion about standards. It seems that is a standard to be applied to determine whether this medical procedure or medical device should be allowed or approved, and the standard that seems to be discussed in 38.624 regarding medical rehabilitation seems to be reasonably needed. And then 38.26, this describes the services that should be available immediately after an injury, also uses the language reasonably needed. So, again, when it says under medical rehabilitation, defining what is medical rehabilitation to which the claimant's entitled, it says the medical services and supplies to which an employee suffering a work injury is entitled shall include appliances, apparatus, and supplies as are reasonably needed for the employee's greatest possible medical rehabilitation. So can you tell me what standard you think was applied in this case? Was reasonably needed applied as the standard?
I would agree that the standard is reasonably needed.
All right. And then looking then at the findings of fact of the board, it appears that the board made a specific finding of fact, 20, but the finding of fact was that the requested Neuromonics device is not reasonable and necessary. And the reasonable and necessary language seems to be language that is referred to in the ICA's opinion also. So my question is, if reasonably needed is the standard, where did this language reasonable and necessary come from? And incidentally, that's also language that's in the conclusions of law of the board, where it says the device is not reasonable or necessary medical treatment. Where did that come from, this idea of necessary? Do you know?
I wouldn't know. And I have, in fact, Mr. Choi and I have been doing this for a while. The reasonable and necessary language has always been used, and I've always regarded those as interchangeable. I may be wrong.
Isn't that actually a tort standard, reasonable and necessary medical expenses, et cetera?
That I would agree. That's a tort standard.
And actually, this is a different standard, a work comp standard, reasonably needed for the greatest medical benefit.
Right.
I would agree,
put it in those terms, yes, and I never thought about it in terms of the tort stamp, but you're correct.
What is your argument as to why, it appears that they're physicians with opinions on both sides and that the LIRAB chose to credit the employers or insurance companies' physicians? Why is it your position that that was in error for it to do so, and that we should reach a different outcome here?
Yes, I'll address that. And it's because Dr. Lucy Shea, an ontologist and a neurotologist, recommended the Neuromonics device. And by the way, the Neuromonics device is still in use today in terms of a device, if one were to look on the American Tinnitus Association website, that is one type of device. Back in, say, 2008 or 2007, it might not have been known, but today it's still used, easily verifiable. But anyway, Dr. Lucy Shea, from her opinion, she was familiar with the device, and she's the only specialist in that area, in that field, with respect to hearing and hearing loss and tinnitus, that gave any kind of competent medical advice or opinion. The employers have these general, you could say, opinions by Dr. Murrow. He is a neurologist. He was not familiar. He had to read about the Neuromonics device. And of course, the other two doctors have really no medical background in this type of treatment. So that's the reason why.
Didn't Murrow actually say, I am not aware whether a Neuromonic device is available for treatment of the condition? I mean, that's his actual words.
Right. So he was.
And then he says, neither am I aware whether the device is an accepted standard of treatment. And the panel or the board accepted his opinion despite having someone who said, who was an expert in the field, and said it isn't acceptable. I mean, what strikes me too about the board going one way on this is that it's interesting that the statute specifically talks about based on competent medical advice, and I'm wondering if it's competent medical advice when somebody says, I'm not even familiar whether it's a standard of treatment.
Right, and the thing about the ICA affirmed the board's findings on that, citing, favoring with Dr. Morrow. And then the board really did the ICA really did a stretch, I feel, in defining a healthcare provider. Healthcare provider doesn't have to be an expert, you know, and so accepted the general opinion of these, they are experts, but not in the expert, the field of otology or neurotology. So,
Would you disagree with the proposition that doctors who may not be experts in a particular field can offer opinions and those can be relied on by the LIRAP?
I would agree, but it just depends upon the type of injury.
And what's different about this case? So what is it about this case that you think justifies getting away from that general principle that docs, you know, physicians who might be generalists or might not have used a particular type of treatment could nevertheless offer opinions?
The difference is this is a TBI, traumatic brain injury case. My client suffered a skull fracture from that work accident, and Dr. William Obana had to remove fragments of skull from his head. My client has two titanium plates in his skull affixed to protect his brain, basically. So that's the difference, and it becomes very complex because not only, and Dr. Aurora mentioned this, it becomes complex because not only has a physical injury, but he has cognitive deficits as well as emotional, and as the record indicates, he suffers from major depression. So that's what makes it different. And I have to remind the court, if I may, that Dr. Lucy Shea recommended this treatment, this NeuroMonics device treatment, while my client was at a brain treatment center. My client simply did not go online to seek this kind of a device or any of the doctors. He was in a treatment facility for his TBIs, traumatic brain injury, and that's when Dr. Shea, the specialist, came in and recommended this type of treatment. And one other thing I should mention, too, that perhaps they didn't emphasize enough in my brief, is that my client did see earlier, maybe a couple years early before being admitted into the Brain Treatment Center in California, he saw Dr. Raymond Tan, an ENT specialist. And Dr. Raymond Tan did the testing, and he found that my client had these deficits, hearing deficits and tinnitus. He diagnosed all of that. And Dr. Tan prescribed this masking device where my client would listen to soothing music. And as the record indicates, or as my client testified at the hearing, it proved ineffective.
I'm sorry. No. Chief Justice, go ahead.
No. How much does the device cost? Is that why they don't want to pay for it? That and the subsequent treatment?
The PAC Blue report says the device costs about $5,000.
And then the subsequent treatment would be on the mainland?
Would be on the mainland, but what would happen would be that when Dr. Patterson came by or some, I forget how it would be. The fitting would be on the mainland and then try to have some follow-up there, or if the doctors were here, do the follow-up here. So it would be like a 6 month follow up.
The fitting would be on the mainland, or what would be?
The initial fitting would be on the mainland, and then the follow up could be there or here, depending upon where the doctor was.
Go ahead. All right, thank you. Mr. Ikihara, amitriptyline was prescribed for the tinnitus, and that was prescribed by whom?
I think that was prescribed by Dr. Robert Marvitt.
Mm-hmm. And getting back to your concern about the expertise of the doctors that gave opinions, amitriptyline was prescribed for tinnitus not by an expert such as Dr. Shea, but by a psychiatrist, Dr. Marvitt, and there are a number of other doctors that have participated who have given information about his condition, including his treating physician, Dr. McCaffrey, who also is not an expert in otology or an expert as even a neurologist. But Dr. Morrow's a neurologist, right?
Correct.
So a neurologist would suggest some expertise in, you know, the area of treating for conditions of the nerves, which certainly hearing relates to. So just to get back to your point, you're suggesting that Dr. Shea has great expertise, but are you saying that the LIRABs had the discretion to listen to the other experts as well, even though they're not specific experts in otology or Dr. Shea's specialty?
So you're saying that the...
I'm just saying you have a variety of doctors here. One of them has credentials that may stand out more than the others, but it's hard to discuss this case if we exclude, as a matter of law, the opinions of, you know, other doctors that don't have quite the expertise of Dr. Shea.
I understand. I believe I understand the question.
I think
that's fine that they could... You would consider that, but again.
All right. Well, accepting that the LIRAB sort of had to deal with the information that's given to them, right? The doctors that come before them.
That's correct.
When they focused on this, I'm interested, was there ever any focus on the actual standard? That is, whether you're going to apply this standard that doesn't seem to have a lot of legal support, reasonable and necessary, or the standard reasonably needed. Did Dr. Morrow or Dr. Arora ever actually discuss that standard?
I don't think they did, if I recall.
All right. Thank you.
Does it help your client's case that there was a long series of treatments which appeared to be ineffective for dealing with this condition? I mean, is that a factor that we might take into account in agreeing that it made sense, or this might be a case where the expert who recommended this device, their opinion should be given great weight or actually dispositive weight?
I would agree that his efforts to try to rehabilitate in the past didn't work, so he goes to and tries a different modality. And that happens all the time in a work comp case. Chiropractic care doesn't work. They do massage therapy. They try something else. They go to the doctor and says it doesn't work. Let me try acupuncture, or the doctor recommends. And you know, they try to find the right modality to give them release. And claimants are all different. So how they respond differently also.
I mean, it just would seem that Mr. Pallava, who's had this condition for a long time, apparently has, you know, seen a number of doctors trying to address the condition, finally find somebody who offers him some hope of being able to handle that condition or address it, and then on the other side there are docs who don't even know about that treatment saying, well, you know, we don't understand it, we're not familiar with it. Is that a somewhat unique situation, and one in which we might be justified, or the board might be justified in giving dispositive weight to that one expert as opposed to crediting those who have more general expertise?
I think so. It's not unusual for treatment to be done on the mainland because the doctors there and the university have more extensive study and research. And even Dr. Arora stated that perhaps for my client's constant, intractable, I think he used the word, headaches, that perhaps seeing a Dr. Raskin in some university in California would help. Even that came from Dr. Arora, employer's opinion, and just as an aside, Dr. Arora wrote a close to 180-page IME report, single space, and if this court wants to get a good feel of the medical history, read Dr. Arora's dissertation, I would say. It's really complete.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to ask you, since we're kind of talking about Dr. Arora's recommendation, further recommendation. I was interested in the conclusion, I guess it's 22 in the decision order, where it says, further, the board credits the opinions of Drs. Goodyear, Morrow, Arora, and finds the claimant's condition to be medically stable and that the claimant is capable of working. So I guess two things. One, I wondered how the stability coincided with Arora's recommendation that he might be able to get something additionally. And I also wondered, this capable of working, I didn't read all these doctors' reports, but did they identify what kind of job he could do, what kind of work, or how many hours a day, and isn't that part of the requirement?
That's correct, and I thank you very much for getting into that area. That leads to my next point of what I say is error, clearly erroneous findings. No, there has been no identification of what type of job. And the way the doctors put it, my client can go back to work, or Mr. Pulava can go back to work to a job that's commensurate with his condition. I don't know, what does that mean?
I mean, could it be babysitting? I mean, they were, and I'm not trying to be facetious, because one of the things they related was that he was watching kids in the day and going to Ala Moana. Would babysitting constitute sufficient to satisfy the statutory requirements for working?
No, it wouldn't. It would be, what's the phrase, substantial gainful employment, if I understand the statute correctly.
Well, doesn't the statute, Mr. Ikihara, 386-1, in defining able to resume work, refer to an occupation for which the worker has received previous training, for one, and I don't think, and I could be corrected, I don't think there's anything in the record to suggest that he can return to previous training as a construction supervisor, but then it goes on to say, or for which the worker has demonstrated aptitude. So in line with what Justice Pollack was saying, is there a discussion anywhere in the record about what Mr. Pulava has demonstrated aptitude for that would support a finding that he's able to resume work?
There's no discussion there. There's absolutely nothing. There usually, I've been doing work comp for 20 years, and, as well as Mr. Choi. And what happens is that the doctor declares the claimant medically stable, and then refers the claimant, if he has an impairment, to an FCE, and a functional capacity evaluation, and from there to VR. The VR counselor takes the FCE and looks at the limitations, and then interviews the claimant and gets some background and tries to figure out what job would be appropriate given the limitations of the particular claimant, physical limitation, mental limitations, background and experience, and then tries to figure out what kind of job that person is capable of doing. In this case, nothing like that. And my contention here is that my client is not even, Mr. Pulava is not even medically stable. He still needs treatment. Remember now, he has a traumatic brain injury. Dr. McCaffrey said he's still behind the eight ball in this. He suffers not only from tinnitus, but intractable headaches, but also depression, and not just depression, but major depression, any one of which could prevent him from working. He has all three. He's definitely behind the eight ball on this. Just as an aside, and addressing Justice Pollack's point, I believe the Social Security Administration and the Disability Claims has gotten it right. They do an assessment, complete assessment. They use what is called the GRID system. And they take into consideration residual capacity, age, knowledge, skill, so forth. Work comp really doesn't. And because they don't have the grid of the standards, it's just left up to an IME doctor to give an opinion that says the client or the claimant can go back to work.
Is there any limitation on the number of IMEs an employer can request?
Not that I know of, although I've had one case where I had five IMEs done. And that was more because the employers, each one of them, five different employers, tried to deny liability.
So coming back to the TTD, what is your request that this court order?
My request is that the court resume TTD payments. I know that there's ample certifications, disability certification by Dr. McCaffrey, and also by Dr. Marvitt, that says that my client is.
What are the grounds on which TTD can be terminated as a matter of law? And where is that set out?
That would be he's able to resume 386.31, that he's able to resume work and or by order of the court.
He's so able to resume work in what?
I think the other one is by order of the court or the board. I have.
That is my question, actually. I think it's order of the director. But so it says he's able to resume work or by order of the director. Can the director just terminate TTD even if a worker is not able to resume work?
There's usually a hearing. There has to be some kind of basis.
Well, the director sends out a notice, right? Correct. Or an employer sends out a notice saying if you want to contest this determination that you can go back to work, you have several weeks to request a hearing and we'll have a hearing, correct?
A hearing has to be.
Right. But can a director terminate TTD without any finding that the claimant is able to return to work? I mean, what are the grounds on which a director can terminate TTD?
In my experience, I've never seen the director do it like, sua sponte on its own. I've never seen that. It's always done by the employer or the insurance company, and then there's a hearing or not if it's not contested.
In this case, the employer is saying that your client is medically stable because even though he does still suffer from these particular ailments, that improvement was not reasonably expected. So under 1210.1, he's still rateable, I assume, and stable. What argument do you have in response to that?
Again, he's still treating with Dr. McCaffrey
Even though he's still under treatment, you understand the employer's argument is he may be treated, but he's still under treatment, but he's still stable and rateable.
Right, and the employer has not scheduled any PPD rating.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
Yeah, the employer has not gone any further than that, and if he's medically stable, then they should have ordered scheduled a PPD rating. No, not according to the record, yeah.
And why not if improvement is not reasonably expected?
The Neuromonics device, I remember my client testified that he gets only 4 hours of sleep a night if he's lucky. Yeah, and that's because of his headaches and his tinnitus. And then aside from that, again, separately is the major depression. I'm going to reserve time, 5 minutes?
I'll give you a little bit of time at the end. So we've been peppering you with questions during the time you reserve, so I will give you some time for rebuttal. Anything further from the court at this time? All right, then we'll hear from Mr. Choi.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Your Honor, I believe that the employer, with respect to the litigation which has ensued in this longstanding case, both at the Labor and Industrial Relations Appeals Board level, with respect to the filings in the appellate case disposed of at the Intermediate Court of Appeals level, and of course with regard to the opposition to the writ of certiorari in this case, we have a brief opposition, and I'm ready to entertain questions.
Well, if I could impose on you for a question, Mr. Choi, that was the same one I was asking Mr. Ikihara's help on, and that is, where did the standard reasonable and necessary come from?
In the years that we have seen these reference reasonable and necessary, I believe it has arisen out of an amalgam of practice and dicta, which has arisen at the appeals board as well as the disability compensation division level. I realize that the statute does reference a different standard, but in terms of art as practitioners, we have the standard reasonable and necessary.
Isn't that a higher standard than reasonably needed for greatest medical rehabilitation?
I would agree it is a higher standard than what is needed for reasonable rehabilitation, but that is the way that the workers' compensation practice has evolved.
So we should defer to the practice rather than the legislature's intent in the statute, the clear language of the statute?
Yes, even though the legislature appears to have a very clear intent in the statute, if the standard at the administrative level and at the quasi-judicial level, which is the Labor and Industrial Relations Appeals Board, if they adopt by practice over years a higher standard, that is the one that we have always...
A higher standard that is actually not good for workers. We should go ahead and go with that standard.
Not necessarily that it's not good for workers, but I believe that in the court's initial colloquy to Mr. Ikihara, you asked if the burden of proof was on the worker to establish reasonableness and necessity. I would disagree. Usually the burden is on the employer, and that's the way we've always operated. If the request for treatment comes in, then the employer must, within 7 calendar days, file a written request opposing it. If not, then you run the risk, if it proceeds to a hearing, that it will be deemed waived and that the employer is responsible for any type of medical care or treatment plan, consultation, referral, as need may be.
But if it's contested, who's burden?
If it is contested, then the employer is required to submit competent medical evidence to support its position, and ultimately the determinant factor is the Department of Labor must make a decision on any challenge, such in this case to the Neuronics device, as well as the appeals board, which has recourse any agreed party to seek a review of the department's decision.
Okay, I understand that you said that the employer would have to submit information, but my question still is, who has to show it's reasonably needed?
The requirement of reasonable necessity would fall to the physician requesting the specific treatment or device.
So it is on the claimant.
It would be on the claimant.
Okay, I want to go back to the standard. Your position, if I heard it correctly, is very different from Mr. Ikihara, who said reasonably necessary, reasonably needed were essentially, I'm sorry, reasonable and necessary and reasonably needed were essentially interchangeable. If I understand your position, you're suggesting they actually are quite different, and we should defer to the interpretation or to the reasonable and necessary, which in your view is a higher standard and different from what the statute requires? Did I get your argument correct, Mr. Choi?
Your Honor, that would be my position, because that is the model that we've operated under for a number of years.
Even if it violates a statute?
Even if it's deferential or different from the statute, the way the standard is applied is that the burden is still on the employer, for the most part, to go forward with competent evidence of a sufficient weight to rebut the presumption that the care and treatment is reasonable and necessary.
Hasn't this court also ruled that that presumption does not apply to this type of situation?
Would the court be referring to Miyamoto?
I can't remember the name of the case. I'm really sorry. But the one that said that the presumption applies to the work, whether or not it's a work injury, but not to all of the treatment.
Correct. It only applies to the work injury, I believe. If I recall correctly, Your Honor, it's Miyamoto. But I know in Cobbles, too, the court also had dicta. You referenced necessary. And so I believe, you know, going back with reference to the guidance from the court and the appellate opinions, dicta sometimes is picked up by the practitioners and the individuals at the Department of Labor, and that's where these types of understandings evolve.
Well, Mr. Gihara, with...
Can an understanding or a practice of an agency trump specific statutory language?
In most cases, I would agree it could not trump it, but you would look at how it is applied, Your Honor.
But that's if the language is ambiguous or if it's not clear. But the language, if there's a standard in the statute, you're sort of asking us to disregard it and not enforce the will of the legislature. I'm not sure we're allowed to do that.
No, as far as the standard, if you go reasonably necessary, medically and reasonably necessary, I believe whatever the terms of art is as far as the standards, the way it is applied is that it is still incumbent upon an employer, if they disagree with a request for treatment, to go forward with evidence to rebut and to support their position.
Okay, you know, I have a question. Under 38624, the claimant is entitled to medical services and supplies that are reasonably needed for the employee's greatest possible medical rehabilitation. Now, you have a claimant who's had, and if you've ever had tinnitus, it's just awful, right? It's just pervasive. He's had this unremitting tinnitus for many, many years, and it's plagued him, and he has a device that, it's not 100%, but what is 100%, that could relieve this tinnitus. How does the employer get around that this is an apparatus that is reasonably needed for the employee's greatest possible medical rehabilitation?
One of the standards that the employers look at is whether the requested device is medically reliable. In this case, if you look at Dr. Shea's October 21, 2007 request, and it's a one-page letter to Dr. Patterson when claimant was treating at Casa Colina in California. Dr. Shea's October 31, 2000 letter indicated that she was considering a relatively new tinnitus treatment that may be beneficial. And she wasn't certain whether or not it would or would not be beneficial. I believe the May qualification was what the Intermediate Court of Appeals focused on as far as questioning whether or not this was something which would be medically reasonable.
But on the docs, I'm sorry, on the employer's side, they had employers who, physicians who weren't even familiar with this treatment. Two of them, if I understood, and please correct me if I'm wrong, two who were not familiar with it, one of whom had done some reading about it, as opposed to someone who's actually familiar with it. What, in our view, is it appropriate or the resolution that the, in these circumstances, is it appropriate for the Labor Board to defer to those physicians who are, even though they're not familiar with this device?
I know that Dr. Anthony Morrow did the research. He did elicit information from articles, and he was of the opinion that he had not heard of this type of treatment before, and that he questioned whether or not this Neuromonics device would alleviate or essentially cure claimant of this tinnitus condition. But Dr. Arora also believed...
Well, if I could stop you there just for a moment, Mr. Gihara, when you're talking about Dr. Morrow, it's a little unclear what... please help me in your explanation that somehow he felt that it was unlikely that Neuromonics device would be useful, because in his report he says, and this is what's quoted by the board in their finding number 8, but they quote him as saying, proposed treatment with a Neuromonic device can be reviewed on their merits as reflected in available placebo-controlled clinical trials, if there are any. It says, my literature review did not reflect the basis for enthusiasm. Okay, well, I would assume enthusiasm might mean strong endorsement for ongoing efforts to treat the tinnitus, but the fact he doesn't have enthusiasm doesn't necessarily suggest he doesn't think it's not appropriate or likely. And then, more specifically, with reference to what the Chief Justice was talking about, when he talks about the literature, he found an article of dated May of 2003 where the treatment was described as promising. but the study lacked an ideal placebo control. So I'm not sure how you can interpret the findings of Dr. Morrow as saying that he feels the mnemonic device isn't workable or unlikely to help. I'm not sure where that conclusion would come from. He's not enthusiastic about it, but it doesn't mean it.
One standard, I believe doctors, if unfamiliar with a specific type of treatment or device, as Dr. Morrow did in this case, was to conduct literature research. You have these publications, as the court is aware, that did not really offer what appeared to be full endorsements of the neuromonitoring
well,
device.
Now we're talking about words like full endorsement. I'm not disagreeing, and if that's where you are, full endorsement might be the way to accurately describe it. But getting back to this idea of actually a standard, I mean, this is a gentleman, the claimant, who's had this problem that's undisputed for nearly a decade. He's been taking medication for it that hasn't worked out. Finally, he gets an idea, gets a recommendation from an expert about a device that might work, and then the IME is done. And for the IME, that background is analyzed, but it doesn't seem to have been analyzed with reference to the law. There doesn't seem to be any discussion of the, you could say, reasonable necessary, if that's the standard that you'd like to have applied, or reasonably needed, the one that's described under the law. But is there anywhere in Dr. Morrow's report where he actually talks about the law? I mean, he talks about a lack of enthusiasm. As you say, maybe there's not a full endorsement, but I think we can both agree that wouldn't necessarily mean it's not reasonably needed. So does he ever use that term?
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, when doctors are asked to provide opinions, we understand and have directed them many years ago to limit their opinions to medical ones only. Now, when the court is asking, does the physician address the legal standard? If that occurred, there is a line of cases from the Labor and Industrial Relations Appeals Board which have shut down and which have disregarded opinions of physicians which take into account legal standards, such as the presumption of compensability makes it a work comp claim or does not make it a workers'
well,
comp claim.
Well, I understand, and that's a useful point, but for the doctor to use a word like needed wouldn't necessarily mean he's using a disqualifying legal term or a term that would say the doctor feels that it isn't necessary. But I don't see even commonly used terms that would describe the degree to which this is something that ought to be available.
Well, I cannot say that I can stand in the shoes or put myself in the shoes of the arbiters, which in this
well,
case were the Department of Labor and Appeals Board.
Fortunately, you're a very experienced litigator in this area, so I'm interested in your view, to the extent you have one, about whether when something's a new procedure, it's just getting started, does that mean that it's automatically disqualified because it's not reasonably needed or reasonable and necessary, or would you say the analysis has to go further than that?
I would say that if there is a new type of treatment for a specific different case that has not been tried before and can be considered, I would not necessarily rule it out, Your Honor. But in this case, I would point out that in the beginning of this case, the petitioner had an extensive amount of treatment, was treated at the Rehabilitation Hospital of the Pacific, and as Mr. Ikehauer noted, he did undergo an ENT otolaryngeal evaluation and was prescribed a masking device. Now, the Neuromonix device is a specific brand, and it consists of a similar type of masking overlay technology. It might be a little bit different, and it would be approximately $3,500 to $4,500, as noted in the reports. It takes 6 months for the doctors to fit and then to go back and adjust the tuning of the device. But that is it. It is something to mask, but it's not curative.
That might be an important frame of reference, but it's not one that's discussed by the doctors at all. I mean, you're bringing it up here, but I don't see it discussed with respect to the folks that were actually the source of medical information for the Labor and Industrial Relations Appeals Board.
I have a question with respect to Dr. Marvitt. Is he the physician under 386-22 in this case, a licensed physician chosen by agreement of the employer and employee? Is he?
Well, I don't know if it's under 386-22, Your Honor, but I know the 386-1-1, it does identify physicians. I know claimant's initial treating physician after the traumatic work injury claim was Dr. Barrett Odegaard, and then Dr. Marbot was concurrently treating at the same time. Then when Dr. Odegaard determined he could no longer attend to claim, then Dr. Marbot became the primary care physician, primary attending physician. And then we now have Dr. Scott McCaffrey.
But in terms of when Dr. Marbot was treating, is he considered a physician under 386-22?
Yes, he would be considered a physician for workers' compensation purposes, yes.
For certified to be necessary by, is he the licensed physician chosen by agreement of the employer and employee under 386-22?
No, there was no, in fact, there was, the record reflects some initial dispute as to whether Dr. Marbot could assume responsibility, but he wasn't mutually agreeable or chosen between.
So there is no such physician in this case?
There's no such physician. The under workers' compensation, the employee has the right of selection of any physician, and then they also have the right of first exercise of change of physician, but not, it's usually very unusual where the employer has a say as to which physician the employee should or could go to. It's very unusual.
Coming back to the question of this device, I'll ask you the same question I asked Mr. Ikehara. Does it matter that there's a whole history here of treatments that have not been able to resolve the condition? Is that a factor that's relevant for the board or us, for that matter, to take into account in deciding whether awarding this or authorizing this treatment is appropriate?
That is a factor that was argued on behalf of the employer at the lower levels. Given the amount of time that has passed, the efficacy of treatment usually at the inception of the injury, when administered, has the best promise or potential for recovery. When a number of years have passed, in this case, when this was initially diagnosed and discussed, close to 11 years have passed. So this tinnitus condition had existed. It had previously been addressed by a prior physician, and there was no further treatment or follow-up. Therefore, there was a question in the employer's mind as to whether this device now, coming on the heels 11 years later, was medically reasonable or necessary.
Actually, couldn't it cut in the other direction, which is this employee or this individual, Mr. Pulava, has had this condition for quite some time. He's subjected to a number of different treatments. Those treatments haven't resolved the condition. We now have a physician, and I don't think anyone is suggesting that Dr. Shi, I think that's how, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, is in any way not competent, not someone who could be relied on by the board. And in those circumstances, wouldn't there be an argument that, again, even if this is a treatment that's not fully established, that it would be a reasonable treatment in these circumstances or needed to help him achieve the greatest possible medical rehabilitation? Because, frankly, there's not much else out there on the horizon at this point in the case that appears likely to help him. And isn't there an obligation to try to help him by giving him things that are reasonably needed to get that result?
I would agree with the last statement you made, Your Honor. And as far as whether or not it is something that could help, again, it should be kept in mind that tinnitus is not something that is curable, but it could alleviate the symptoms. But really,
alleviate the symptoms.
However, the most overriding concern here is not so much that the tinnitus is the disabling medical condition in this case, but rather the effects of the traumatic brain injury, the psychological aspects of the claim, which have stabilized. And in deference to Mr. Ikehara's argument that Mr. Pulava, the petitioner, is not yet stable, I would point the court to the neuropsychiatric evaluation of Dr. Brian Goodyear. And Dr. Goodyear, in his most recent report of May 30, 2008, did reference he had initially seen the petitioner and evaluated him in 1999 and 2004, and then most recently in 2008. And he did assess him with what is called an impairment rating of 25% neuropsychiatric, pursuant to the American Medical Association guides to the evaluation of permanent impairment. So the neuropsychiatric, the traumatic brain injury episode, the neurological aspects, that's the most overriding concern in this whole case. But the focus appears to be on tinnitus, which Dr. Morrow does agree is in part due to the work injury, in addition to exposure to loud noises, as the petitioner was working on a construction site since, I recall, 1974.
But what work is he now capable of doing? I mean, what that was, you know, a focus here, and that he's medically stable. You've just given the argument that he's medically stable. What is the basis and the conclusion and the type of job that he can now hold?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that's kind of a question like, which came first, chicken or the egg? And I don't mean to downplay that, but with respect to the question you asked, it is a vocational one. It is not a medical question. The vocational rehabilitation aspects under workers' compensation, specifically Statute 386-25, addresses this type of question.
Is he in VR?
He was initially referred to Vocational Rehabilitation Services in 1997, and then the Vocational Rehabilitation Counselor, Gary Whitney, felt that the petitioner was medically infeasible, needed to seek further care and treatment until he could consider feasibility. In vocational rehabilitation, feasibility is defined in the rules, indicating that within the professional competence of the Vocational Rehabilitation Council, they feel they can assist the injured worker in returning to suitable and gainful employment in a cost-effective and in as quickly a manner as possible. In this case, that was never done. After 1997, the Vocational Rehabilitation Unit was essentially disbanded due to the budgetary cuts imposed by then Governor Cayetano. So then the referral system, self-referral system, became the norm. That is, if an injured worker or their counsel believed that the worker desired or sought out vocational rehabilitation, they would initiate the referrals. Alternatively, if the employer felt that a number of years had gone by without voc rehab being implemented, could petition the director to refer them out. In this case, we have a vocational assessment from Priscilla Haver, and seeing that this would be a problem, we obtained her assessment, and she is a certified counselor.
Wait, is this part of the record? And this was relied on by LERAP?
Yes, it was part of the record as well and relied on because in looking at the case, the employer felt it necessary to complete the circle because we had the medical opinions, but we did not have any updated vocational assessment to address the return to work, ability to resume work questions. Those are within the sphere of vocational rehabilitation and not of a physician.
And when was that done? I'm sorry.
This was November 6, 2008. It was Exhibit 5 to, at the appeals board level, the employer's post-hearing position.
Is that a part of the LERA's findings? Do they rely on it?
The LERA, I don't recall if they specifically refer to the consultation report, but it was raised in argument, and we did brief it.
Just coming back, so focusing on this TTD issue, Mr. Ikehara basically said the employer failed to do what it needed to do procedurally, which I think was to refer for an evaluation and a termination. Is what you're arguing now that, in effect, that evaluation took place?
Yes, we did a vocational assessment, and Ms. Haver did review the prior sparse report. It was a first and final because of a vocational rehabilitation counselor feels they do not have the capability to assist the worker in returning to suitable alternative gainful employment. Then they submit a first and final report. They're supposed to do or perform the initial evaluation within 45 days of the referral of the case to them. Mr. Whitney did that, but he found that he could not assist the claimant and deemed the claimant, or in this case, the petitioner, infeasible for services. We then had Ms. Haver review the file, and she also believed that at this time, feasibility as of that time of her report in 2008, that it was highly questionable. Highly questionable because the petitioner viewed himself as retired and had removed himself from the labor market. Now, with respect to that assessment by the certified vocational rehabilitation counselor, we then believe that it fell within the parameters of Ashley versus Bank of Hawaii, where no matter what an employer or vocational rehabilitation counselor attempts to do. If the injured worker is not motivated to return to work or has expectations, then they're not going to return to work.
But motivation is the last sentence?
They are not. You have unreasonable expectations. The injured worker will not resume work. It's all motivation.
Okay, so my question is then, instead of that kind of finding, we have a finding that says he is capable of working.
The capable of working, I believe, emanated from the medical opinions of Drs. Goodyear, Morrow, and Arora.
Mr. Kihar, I think you're referring to the finding number 14 of the board, and in that finding, Ms. Havra's work is cited. But again, it does not indicate that he's able to return to work. I think your argument is she found he had a bad attitude, so it wouldn't even be worth referring him for a determination of his likelihood for vocational rehabilitation, right? But if, following Justice Pollack's point, if notwithstanding what Ms. Havra said, which he ought to be evaluated to see whether he could return to work, the board relied on Dr. Goodyear to find that he actually could return to work. Dr. Goodyear says he's capable of returning to some type of productive employment. And it's your position that that comports with the statute 386-1 that says that there has to be a finding that the worker is able to perform work for which he's demonstrated an aptitude? Because this seems awfully general what Dr. Goodyear has decided, and in the face of what the vocational rehab counselor has said, that he ought to at least get services, I'm not sure if this is the only thing in the record, how a conclusion could be reached that now he's stable and ready to return to work. And it's not clear what work, except that it's clear he can't return to the work he performed previously.
In answer to your question, Your Honor, and then Justice Pollack, on page 2 of Dr. Goodyear's May 30, 2008 report, he noted that the petitioner was psychologically stable as of 1999, but the barrier to participation in vocational rehabilitation was more the result of motivational factors versus objective neuropsychiatric impairment. When the doctors say that they're capable of work, they come from a medical perspective. That has to be then weaved into analysis, which the vocational rehabilitation counselor performs.
But that doesn't give much specificity as to what work can he do now, given his bad attitude.
Well, I wouldn't qualify it as bad attitude, Your Honor, but rather a lack of motivation to attempt to return to alternative work where the financial disincentive is so high, he, if he returned to work, would earn less than he was collecting then on Social Security, the union retirement benefits, as well as then temporary total disability. The record indicates anywhere from $4,400. And if you look at the earnings of the petitioner at the time of the work injury.
But isn't that considered to be a less than positive attitude when somebody's decided, despite the fact they can return to work, they're not just because they want to get the benefits, even though they're actually employable and can return to work? Would you consider that sort of a negative concept?
Well, it's an individual determinant, Your Honor, and if the individual is not motivated to participate in voc rehab and the factors indicate to the two vocational rehabilitation counselors, Mr. Whitney and Ms. Hover, that he isn't feasible, then no matter what they try to do, he will not return to work.
But you see what I'm saying? Logically, how does that mean he's capable of returning to work if he has this attitude that's counterproductive towards working because he just as soon get his benefits?
Capable of return to work usually is on initially the medical perspective, and three physicians here, Drs. Goodyear, Morrow, and Arora, feel from their perspective, the physical, neuropsychiatric, and psychiatric, that he is capable of working within restrictions, but you never get to that point to determine what he can do because the vocational rehabilitation counselors feel that motivation is a strong disincentive to participation and a genuine exploration of return to suitable alternative gainful employment.
So does the law say that if an employee, for whatever reason, may not be motivated, because we don't really know what it's like to be in a person's shoes, right, to have a 12 by 6 inch rock hit your head and depress your head and have all of these brain injuries and the tinnitus that continues. We don't know what that's like. So does the law say that if a person is not motivated, they can be cut off?
Not so much as not motivated, Your Honor. In the workers' compensation area, if the employer produces the quantum of sufficient medical evidence to establish medical stabilization, maximum medical improvement, and that vocational rehabilitation has been explored or in some cases terminated, then temporary total disability benefits can be terminated. And in this case, it was by order of the director.
And then we would get to permanent partial disability.
Yes, then we address the issue of permanent partial disability, which was left open in the director's last, as I recall, 2009 determination.
I have a final question on the neuromonic device. You know, the employer authorized him to be consulted, to have a consultation as to whether or not he should get the device. But then when the doctor said, yes, he needs it, the employer said no.
As far as what
Why authorize the consultation if you're going to say no if when the doctor says it's needed?
That aspect was when the claimant was up, or Mr. Pulava, the petitioner, was in Casa Colina, California. The information transfer occurred between the representative, the adjuster for the insurance carrier at that time. And I'm not sure as far as the consultation, but a number of recommendations were made, and they were essentially transmitted and allowed. Mr. Pulava spent a period of time, approximately 5 months, in Casa Colina, at which time he was undergoing a multidisciplinary approach for treatment.
This was the treatment that the employer initially denied and then was ordered to allow. So he went for 5 months. And as a part of that treatment, they said he needs this, that this device would be helpful. And that was a part of the consultation there that was approved. But now, because he was back in Hawaii, the employer refused to allow him to continue and have that device.
There were questions about the efficacy or the reasonableness of that type of recommended treatment by Dr. Kay. Yes.
So reasonably needed would reasonable factors in cost, is that what you're saying?
No, cost is not a factor into it.
Cost is not a factor.
Into it. No. Cost.
So the fact that the employer would have to pay for the employee to go back to California, be fitted maybe several times because there's an adjustment that's necessary, the cost is not something that is at issue.
No, it's the precedent and, of course, the off-island treatment aspect that was questioned. And as far as costs, I will point out to the court that I understand approximately $100,000 was billed by Casa Colina, so, you know, in deference to the issue of costs. No.
Would you like to wrap up your comments? Again, we asked you questions, so at the time you reserved, if you have any closing remarks you'd like to share with us, briefly, Mr. Choi.
Yes, with respect to the position of the employer, the denial of the neuromonics device is supported by the medical opinions of Drs. Goodyear, Drs. Morrow, and Dr. Edgett Arora. They found that there was a question as to the efficacy or existence of this type of relative new treatment. Dr. Shea herself indicated it was relatively new, but Dr. Shea was only specifically focusing on a particular brand or device, and that a similar masking treatment was attempted at the inception of the case and it proved to be ineffective to address petitioner's tinnitus problems. There was then a relative dearth of any addressing or concern about the tinnitus problem until he went up to Casa Colina in 2007. If there was concern about the tinnitus condition being a disabling consequence or a serious medical problem, there should have been a continued documentation and addressing of the problem by either Drs. Odegaard or Marvett at that time. With regard to the second issue raised by petitioner on appeal, whether there was error in the summary disposition order finding that he was capable of work, that is a very, very complicated question. Capable of work does not mean that you have to actually prove that the petitioner could or was able to go back to work. It's a combination of medical and vocational issues. The medical issues first have to do with limitations in medical stability. And medical stabilization was established with respect to the opinions of doctors Goodyear, Morrow, and Aurora. They also opined that the petitioner was capable of working in some capacity within his limitations. Then the next question is, what alternative occupations are there? Because we concede that he cannot return to work as a construction supervisor. However, the barriers imposed in any participation in vocational rehabilitation are the financial disincentives that the petitioner will not be able to make the type of money that he then was receiving through a disability status as if he returned to work. And from the medical reports, it appeared that he was somewhat aware of this possibility. His comment, I believe, I don't want to do anything until I'm 100% recovered. That indicates, according to what we see, that no amount of vocational rehabilitation will return him to union wages as a construction supervisor. But the vocational rehabilitation counselor, particularly Ms. Hobart, found as of that date, 2008, he was infeasible for services because more likely than not, he could not select any other type of job which would replace or perhaps exceed the amount of disability pay that he had been receiving from both Social Security as well as the union retirement for full disability. And at that time, temporary total disability until those benefits were terminated in late 2008.
Yeah, of course. Be sure you're speaking to the mic. I'm sorry, Justice Pollack.
Is your position then, if a person has an attitude, and let's assume that this person says, I don't want to work because I can make more money or whatever it is, there's no responsibility on the employer to demonstrate that there is a feasible occupation for the person to work in?
Because Your Honor, I think we're leaning towards Yarnell. And
I'm leaning towards the definition of what it says. Mm-hmm. It says specifically, capable of performing work in an occupation that he's received or she received previous training or an occupation for which the worker has demonstrated aptitude. And my question is, because somebody has a bad attitude, does that mean the employer doesn't have to demonstrate that there's some occupation the person can feasibly work in?
No, not necessarily, Your Honor. But in this case, that was precluded because petitioner did not take advantage of the fact that he could have participated in vocational rehabilitation at any time and initiate a referral, demonstrating motivation. Once you are imbued in the vocational rehabilitation process, only then can there be an analysis of what alternative vocational possibilities there are. If there was such a development in this case, that would give the employer a basis to argue there were identified other job objectives or possibilities within his limitations that he could return to. But the employer essentially can't just speculate to say you can return to this job or basically there are other occupations out there that you could have gone into. A full vocational assessment was never made in this case because the initial vocational rehabilitation counselor found petitioner to be infeasible, and that was also the assessment of the vocational expert in 2008. So without that underlying information, the employer would have just been engaged in speculation as far as what he could return to. If you don't want to return to work, you cannot be forced to return to work.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Mr. Ikehara, your rebuttal.
Thank you very much. I just had a comment on a couple of things. Reasonably needed, I think, is a totally different standard. Given the purpose of 386, and that is to help the injured worker, so I think it is a lower standard. And it's just one phrase, reasonably needed, as compared to reasonable and necessary. So that's one thing. The other thing is that the NeuroMonics device is not a masking device. What it is, it retrains the brain and desensitizes the brain of the perception of the hissing sound the air compression sound and the high and low sounds. So it desensitizes the brain. So it's different from just putting on a cassette player and playing soothing music.
You can continue. I'll give you some time to complete your rebuttal.
And the VR report, Harvard, and this is the part where it is very confusing. If there is work out there, given his medical records, Priscilla Harver, I think pronounced, could have used her background and knowledge and say, these are the types of jobs available to this type of person who's injured, has these limitations. But she never gave an opinion. She just said summarily, you know, he's not interested, he's not motivated. And I just want to point out one thing in the decision and order by the Labor Appeals Board. I forgot what page it is, but the decision went through what Dr. James Pierce found with respect to motivation. And what Dr. Pierce found that it may appear that he's not motivated, but you know, this is all part of his psychological makeup because he did suffer and this traumatic brain injury. Thank you.
Thank you very much to both our counsel today. The court will take this matter under advisement.